Hello, this is Mick Luro.
And I'm Dave Ebersole.
And together we are Light Booth Blackout.
In the next few moments, you're going to hear some ads.
There may also be an ad break in the middle of this episode.
If you'd like to listen to Dash without any ads or ad breaks,
and who could really blame you?
You can get every episode of Dash ad-free on our Patreon, patreon.com/lightboothblackout.
As a Patreon member, you'll be the very first to hear every episode of Dash as it's released.
You'll also have access to bonus content and special features.
You can support us at patreon.com/lightboothblackout, all one word. You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you for your support, and please enjoy Dash.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello, this is Dave Ebersole. In a few weeks, we'll be starting a brand new miniseries, The Case of the Strange Happenings at the Half Moon Street. But this week, we're shining a light on another podcast, the audio drama Englewood After Dark. Englewood After Dark is a horror mystery fiction podcast with charming characters and wonderful wit. College students Finn and Eve run a true crime conspiracy podcast that explores the secrets that lurk on the haunted campus of Englewood University. I'm a big fan of how this show blends genres with a suspenseful sound design and an ever-growing cast that has amazing chemistry and a plot that keeps you coming back week after week. They'll be wrapping up their season soon, so now is the perfect time to jump on and binge the entire first season. See the show notes for content warnings and more details, and please enjoy the first episode of Englewood After Dark, Finn's Choice.
Welcome to Englewood After Dark, Episode 1, Finn's Choice. Englewood After Dark is a horror audio drama. Content warnings for this episode include mild jump scares, discussions of murder, on-scene murder and abduction, and discussions of suicide. Enjoy!
There, intrepid mystery lovers, and welcome back to Englewood After Dark. I'm your host, Boundless Optimist, and this is my co-host, Miss Killjoy.
That's Lady Killjoy to you.
My apologies, Lady Killjoy. I'm Finn Nightingale, and this is Lady Eve Killjoy Pemberley. And we're coming to you live from our borrowed university studio. Englewood After Dark is a weekly delve into the world just beyond your field of vision. Into the dark and dangerous spaces, beyond what is known, and into the unknown.
Englewood After Dark is a weekly dialogue where Finn attempts to convince me that ghosts are real, and I remind him that this isn't an episode of Supernatural.
If this were Supernatural, we'd both be in super hell.
And this week, Finn dragged me into the woods on his most ridiculous field research yet.
That's right, dear listeners. We're headed into the woods behind campus and up to the old murder farm.
Wow.
I make all my best Amazon purchases at 3 a.m. But we shan't keep you in suspense, lovely listeners. Let's go back to where this all began.
I can't believe you talked me into this.
Scared? I thought you didn't believe in ghosts.
I don't. What I'm scared of is structural collapse.
Well then, what do you know about our campus's most brutal urban legend?
So the story goes like this. There was a professor at the school in... like the 60s, I think, had a real creepy passion for taking young female students back to the farm that borders Englewood campus. Except, when he got them there, it was less a softcore love fest and more an R-rated slasher flick. Then, one day he killed himself, I think? Whatever, his ghost now wanders the farm looking for action. So, understandably, when students go to the farm to get frisky, he really doesn't like it. Rumor has it that every single person who's ever been down there has either died or gone missing. And, of course, the ghost did it.
Oh, of course.
Finn, come on. How much of that is even true?
All the most important parts.
Finn, I got told that story by a drunk guy at my first party here. I sincerely doubt it's even mostly true.
So, everyone knows that the professor started this whole thing. What you got wrong, Eve, was the date. It all happened in the 80s, not the 60s.
Oh, not the summer of love?
No, the summer of death, Eve. With the help of our friendly custodian Samuel, I tracked down the original news articles published on the case at the time.
And why was Samuel helping you?
We have an unspoken bond.
You were alone in the library and he took pity on you trying to use the library catalog?
Unimportant. Because I have the professor's name. Professor Ludwig Schmidt.
Gesundheit.
Anyways, Schmitty...
You're nicknaming the serial killer?
...was married to Isabella Schmidt, nay, Jones, and taught moral philosophy at Englewood. Yep. According to my sources, people in his life noticed that his personality shifted drastically, coinciding with the disappearance of his first victim.
When not going inside?
I'm giving you a tour, and our first spot is outside.
I do not like your tone.
You never do. As I was saying, Schmidt went from being antsy, skittish, and withdrawn to being friendly, sociable, and charming.
Huh. That is weird.
And the weirdest thing by far? He gave up his obsession with Kant.
Finn, you can't say that on air.
No, Eve. Kant. Like Immanuel Kant, the philosopher. Apparently he invited a guest speaker to talk on Kant and was generally obsessed with Kant's ideologies up until the first murder. Schmidt would include Kant in the curriculum for many of his classes, even classes where Kant didn't have much to say about the topic. But then, he gave him up.
So?
Schmidt was a brilliant professor of moral philosophy with a dark and frightening urge that he dare not satisfy. A fear of repercussion instilled in him at an early age and an obsession with figuring out right from wrong. A religious man constantly asking the question.
Dark urges, right. You think Schmidt found the meaning of life and the answer was murder?
Well, I thought you'd like it better than my other explanation for his random mood shift.
Which is? Oh, no, don't tell me.
Possession.
Wow. Dramatic much?
And here we are.
What, the patch of garden?
No, not a patch of garden, Eve. It's the final resting place of Schmidt's three victims.
Jesus. He buried them right here?
Yeah. Jessica Green, Angela DeLuca, and Laura Wilson.
I'm sorry this happened to you guys.
Talking to ghosts now?
It's called paying respect to the dead, dumbass. So go on, storyteller. What happened to
The following is a dramatization. Picture this. It's a hot summer night at Englewood University. The hour is late, and the streets are lit by a pallid yellow glow of electric lamps, drowning out the stars beneath an acrid haze of polluted light. Your name is Marcus Emerson. Intoxication weighs heavy on you as you stumble into the streets after your girlfriend. Your girlfriend, Jessica Green, fled your best friend's party after a fight, and you ventured out into the humid streets in pursuit, heart set on making things right.
Jessica... Come on, baby, I'm sorry. Jess? Baby? Jessica!
Jessica isn't there. You never get the chance to say you're sorry. You never get the chance to tell her that you love her. Hey!
Cut the crap, Finn.
Okay, okay. Marcus assumed, rightfully so, that something had happened to her. They interviewed several other people at the party and along the street, but nobody had seen or heard anything. It seemed like the last person to see her was Marcus. Suspicious, right? Marcus had just had a fight with Jessica, and he finds that she's discarded the bracelet that he gave her. They thought she got upset, broke up with him, and skipped town. Then it got really weird when Marcus started investigating on his own. I couldn't find a lot about the specifics, but apparently he cooked up some wild theories on what happened, and the police started suspecting he was crazy. Like, maybe he was crazy all along, and that's why Jessica ran away from him.
It is often the boyfriend slash husband.
Well, her disappearance was later connected to Schmidt, but before we get to that, shall we investigate the inside?
I don't know. It doesn't exactly inspire thoughts of structural stability, given that the porch is literally crumbling.
That's why I came prepared.
Hard hats? Really? What else do you have in that backpack?
Wouldn't you like to know? Come on, follow me.
Who found the girls in the end? His wife?
Sorta. When the police showed up to investigate his suicide, a brand new deputy, first day on the job, kind of fell into Angela's grave?
Oh, God. What a fucked up first day.
Yeah, I mean, at least it didn't deter him, I guess.
What do you mean?
Oh, he's still on the police force now. Came to campus a few weeks ago to do the drunk driving seminar.
Oh, no. Not the guy whose name I couldn't remember, so I resorted to calling him Pube Man.
Pube Evans, yes. Well, that's Sheriff Pube Evans nowadays.
Clearly his parents hated him. That's a terrible way to double-barrel your names. If this place collapses on us, I'm blaming you.
You sure you're not just afraid we'll encounter the spirit of old Schmitty inside?
Are you for real? Ugh, it smells like vomit and sadness in here.
Yeah, students, despite the clear warning signs of ghostly inhabitants, do like to party up here.
Gross. Do you think ghosts are responsible for all this graffiti, too?
So many eyes on these walls. He's clearly watching us.
Then should I take it, according to you, that the giant dick drawn over the fireplace means he's really happy to see us?
Yeah, but seriously, that's a lot more eyes than anything else. And a lot of different pens, but they drew them the same.
You mean lots of people draw generic eyes in the same way? Groundbreaking.
And there it is.
There what is?
That armchair is, allegedly, the place where Ludwig Schmidt sat to take his own life. It barely looks touched, unlike the rest of the trash in here.
Were the police onto him?
Well, that's the interesting part, Eve. No one was onto old Schmitty. Not until after he killed himself.
So then, why do it? I can't really buy remorse. Serial killers don't tend to feel it.
Exactly. His wife came home from a business trip one weekend to find him dead in his chair. At first, it was looking like a suicide. But then, they found the other girls.
But he wasn't a suspect.
There was, of course, the possibility of a sudden onset of guilt.
In a serial killer?
Seems weird, right? And then they found photos in his basement of a fourth girl he was planning to add to his collection.
Jesus. What else?
They also found several different lipsticks that apparently he'd been reapplying to his victims.
Oh, God. Is that why there are so many lipstick tubes in here? That's so messed up.
Yeah. But the biggest reason they were skeptical of it being a suicide were Schmidt's hands. At first, they didn't notice, but the fingers in his left hand had been broken just before he died. Strange he'd use his messed-up hand to pull the trigger, no?
Was he left-handed?
Yep.
So, whoever wanted it to look like a suicide knew enough to use his left hand and hoped the police wouldn't look close enough to see his fingers.
Precisely. And the cops felt the same. So they began to delve into Schmidt's life to find out the whys. Ooh.
Oh?
Cold spot.
Oh, come on.
Come on yourself, Eve. The original disappearances ended with Schmidt's death, but was only the beginning for the murder farm. Schmidt's ghost is still out there. He could be watching us right now. You screamed!
It was a loud noise. Shut up!
Well, who knows? Maybe Schmidt's with us right now.
You can't be serious. It was the wind.
Oh, come on, Eve. Don't be cliché.
Me? You're the one tempting fate. If you really believe the legend surrounding this place, that Schmidt kills students who come up here to party, why bring us up here?
Huh? Don't worry. We're inoculated. Neither of us wants to bone.
Of course. How could I forget?
But that might be enough for tonight. We can reconvene tomorrow and talk about the other victims in the comfort of the studio.
Now who's scared of ghosts?
I mean me, duh. I'm not hiding that fact.
So, tell me about Schmidt's other victims. Angela and Laura?
You got it. Our next tragic turn of fate brings us to the spring of 1983 and the disappearance of Angela DeLuca. Angela was best known as the captain of the women's volleyball team, the Englewood Woodies.
You have got to be kidding me.
Too weird to be fake, sorry. You can see why they changed it to the Englewood Comets. Anyway, it looks like Angela was a real star athlete. Angela reportedly went for daily jogs on the edge of town with her boyfriend, Eric. So one day, she goes for her daily jog, except this time, she never comes back. The interesting thing is, this time her boyfriend wasn't running with her because he was staying late after sports practice to help with, I don't know, sports stuff.
The world of sports ball is a weird one, yes.
Reportedly, the last person to see Angela was a local cashier. They were on a smoke break and they say they saw Angela at the start of her jog as she headed down the road and remembered waving to her. But they were called inside, and 5 minutes later, when they stepped back out, they didn't see Angela on the road, even though from the store you can see all the way to the far end of the running track. Spooky, right?
There's someone there. This isn't funny.
Now at Menards, save big money on everything for your next project. Shop our huge selection of concrete. From general purpose concrete to specialty sand and mortar mixes, we have what you need to get any job done right. View our entire selection online or in store today and save big money. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views, and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Spooky isn't the word I'd use. Suspicious, certainly, but not spooky.
But her boyfriend wasn't there either. Which means whoever took her knew that her boyfriend wouldn't be there and grabbed her early on in her trip.
I have to imagine that would have narrowed down the list of suspects, right? Was Schmidt included in this list?
You'd think that, but Angela was really popular. There were so many people who knew her regular routine that they couldn't all be interviewed by the police. And the list of people who knew her boyfriend wouldn't be there is almost as big. They knew that whoever kidnapped her was on both of those lists, but they had no way of knowing who. There were still so many names. They had search parties out there for weeks, but they didn't find a thing.
Poor Angela. And a bold move from Schmidt.
Oh, he gets bolder.
Really? It's hard to imagine how he'd top the captain of a sports team, short of murdering an important faculty member.
Not quite. It was Laura Wilson, the school orchestra's first violin. The important bit isn't the who, it's the when. Laura disappeared on the university grounds during an intermission. She left to use the bathroom and had no reason to leave the building.
Oh, the serial killer was inside the opera house?
Yeah, the place fell into hysterics. A lot of wealthy people threatened to withdraw donations and scholarships unless something was done about the security on campus. In hindsight, maybe Schmidt just acquired the keys to the auditorium building, but imaginations were running wild. Some people accused the second violin of conspiring against Laura so they could steal her position. Some thought it could have been the conductor of the orchestra. Could it have been a friend of Laura's? The head of the university?
The custodian?
You leave Samuel out of this.
Samuel is in his 40s. He would have been a child in the 80s, and if my memory serves correctly, child labor laws in the 80s prohibited 7-year-olds from being janitors.
I'll let you off this once.
You're so benevolent.
Don't you forget it. Anyway, the investigation was kept under wraps, probably for security. But this was back when key cards and fobs weren't really a thing. You had regular locks and keys, so they didn't have much to track Laura or her assailant. Honestly, all three victims left very little behind to go off. They should have been cold cases, and they would have if it weren't for Schmidt himself.
Right, the implausible suicide again.
Right you are, Eve. But we'll have to pick this up again after our commercial break. Hey there, you sexy, sexy bibliophiles. This week, Englewood After Dark is proud to announce that we are partnering with the Campus Bookstore. We're coming to the aid of the effervescent Valerie, the shop's newest employee who asked not to be named. Sorry, Valerie. Seems that while doing the stock take, she accidentally held down the one key, and now our campus store has 111 copies of It by Stephen King. So, if you're in the mood to help a lady out, broaden your literary horizons, or just get a good deal, head on down to the store where all copies of the book are now on sale for 50% off. And remember, not all sexy folks read, but all people who read are very, very sexy. Deal only lasts while supplies are available.
Dude, Valerie's going to kill you.
It'll be fine. But speaking of murder...
A truly atrocious segue.
We all know Schmidt's death opened a proverbial can of worms. Not only was his suicide suspicious, but it didn't stop deaths from being linked to the murder farm. In fact, the urban legend grew legs.
It grew legs? Come on, Finn. How certain are you of all of this?
All jokes aside, I got most of this information from a book at the library. There's an Englewood alumni who went here about a couple of decades ago. He's an author now, and his first book is actually all about Professor Schmidt.
Is this a credible source, or did you find it next to Stephen King?
Haha, very funny. No. Learned my lesson from last time.
Blood-soaked soil by C.J. Briggs. Well, that's promising.
He wanted to call it the Englewood Slasher, but there's already an Englewood Stalker, so, you know. Besides, apparently the school reached out to him and asked him to leave our name out of it. Makes sense that they want to leave this behind them.
I'm gonna read this too, to check. But for now, let's assume at least the important details are accurate.
Okay, so, no way this guy killed himself, right? Doesn't fit his new, confident personality. Only reason he'd have to pull the trigger was if someone found out about it.
I'd be willing to bet that someone did find out. I'm assuming his fingers weren't broken before he disappeared for the weekend. I don't mean to stereotype, but a bookworm philosophy professor doesn't sound like they'd be doing too many physical activities that might risk him breaking his fingers. He probably had a fight with someone. Question is, who and why?
What about the wife?
Didn't she have an alibi?
She claims she was away at a conference all weekend, but no one could verify it because she paid in cash.
Flimsy. But if I wanted to kill my husband, I'd want to be seen by as many people as possible. Let's say she did murder him. She found his murder farm, shot him, and then planted the gun and left. She waited 2 days to call the police. Why didn't she make sure she was seen anywhere else?
Maybe she was spending that time cleaning up the crime scene.
48 hours to wipe away fingerprints? Especially given you own the crime scene? It wouldn't be odd to find traces of her anywhere there.
But her alibi is flimsy, like you said. Maybe she's just a bad murderer.
Or she could have waited 48 hours to obscure the post-mortem report and just be terrible at planning ahead for an alibi.
I mean, if she was that bad, wouldn't the police have caught her?
Can't rule her out yet, but does it say in that book who was the last person to see Schmidt alive?
A family friend, Elliot Quinn. Apparently he and Schmidty were hammered when they left the faculty drinks that night. They walked home together around midnight.
Anyone corroborate that?
The next door neighbor woke up when the two of them arrived at Quinn's house. Said they heard them get into an argument. Quinn went on record later saying he didn't remember what the fight was about.
Yeah, but if you're drunk enough to have memory blackouts, you're normally too drunk to get yourself home.
Lady Eve Killjoy Pemberley is clearly an expert on partying hard and being blackout drunk.
Every single time I've been blackout drunk, you've been right there with me.
We're partners in crime. And crime solving.
Okay, so we have potential in Quinn. And in the wife. We should look into them more for next week.
Sounds good to me. Then now it's time to discuss a motive. A wicked, sinister motive. Right after this commercial break.
Oh boy, howdy. Do we have a treat for you today, folks. Our very own Englewood Theatre Department is putting on Oklahoma with a twist. What's the twist? I hear y'all hollering. Well, that's a secret best kept for the actual performance, but I do have some teasers for you. The words alien, time traveler, and pistachios should set your minds racing. It's Oklahoma, but not as we know it. Starring our very own Finn Nightingale and campus favorite Emma Fitzroy. Tickets are on sale in the main office of the drama department. Ask for Mandy. You can also find tickets in the campus shop. And next week, there'll be a pistachio-themed bake sale in the cafeteria to raise funds. So get your tickets now for a night of campus fun. I hate you. Dude, what the hell was that?
Art, Lady Killjoy. That was art.
I'm never letting you write copy for the ad breaks ever again.
Oh, sure you will. You hate writing the ads.
Yeah, I really do.
Now, back to motive. C.J. Briggs has a theory, particularly about how Schmidt's change in attitude might have come about and led to the murders. See, Briggs talks a lot about Schmidt's beliefs in psychology in Chapter 2, called What Makes a Killer.
I hope you know I'll absolutely be vetting any of Briggs' claims about psychology over the next week.
Oh, look at me, I'm Eve. I wrote a whole paper on abominable psychologies, and now I'm an expert in the field.
First, it's abnormal psychology. Second, it's 2 papers now, as well as 5 other psychology papers which are important for my degree. And third, I'm an expert in the field of abnormal psychology because I spend time with you, Finn.
Well then, hey, I'm flattered you think of me as such an excellent case study. Wait, shouldn't you be paying me for participation?
I can offer you a voucher for a free cheeseburger at McDonald's. By taking this compensation, you hereby relinquish your right to your
Deal.
Soul.
Anyway, 1 cheeseburger richer, 1 soul lighter. Let's continue. Schmidt grew up in a strict, religious home. The kind of place where you're subject to a whole lot of rules and punished severely for breaking them. Briggs found a couple of old reports where the cops were called to Papa Schmidt's place, since his teachers found Ludwig with welts on his skin at school. Considering that beating your kids was the great American pastime in the 50s, it must have been brutal to have gotten the cops involved. No wonder Schmidt turned out so bad. I kind of feel sorry for the guy.
Please try not to empathize with serial killers, Finn.
Hey, little Schmidt wasn't a serial killer yet. I'm allowed to feel bad for him. So, after making it through school, Schmidt went to college and studied philosophy, seeming to forget about his parents. Briggs interviewed some students who knew him in college, and he seemed like a quiet guy, but never struck them as particularly religious, though Briggs admits that it was hard to find people who knew Schmidt well enough to say for certain.
An honest self-critique of one's sources. Well played, Briggs.
I told you, this book's the real deal. Anyway, we know where Schmidt went from there. Kant. So, Briggs says that Schmidt got really into Kant's work during his studies, so it looks like his obsession started early. From what I can tell in Briggs' book, Kant's idea of moral was based following a specific set of rules, and Schmidt decided he liked that.
Even in an abusive environment, some people crave the systems they knew as children because it makes them feel stable, I suppose, even if it makes them feel awful in other ways.
Briggs says something along those lines, too. Kant has these rule things he calls the catagogical imperative. No, hold on, give that back for a second. Next page, next page, next page. Wait, last page. And here. Here. The categorical imperative. It's like a litmus test for morality.
That's a terrifying thought. Enlighten me, O wise one. Show me a Kant. I can't say his name.
Don't worry, I'll censor you in post so you can feel better. So, the categorical imperative says that anytime you do something, you should imagine a world where everyone always does the same thing in the same situation that you're in. And then, you should ask yourself if that's the kind of world you want to live in. Like, before you decide to lie to your mother about breaking her heirloom china, Kant says you should imagine a world where everyone lies all the time to cover their butts and nobody takes responsibility for anything.
Ew, that sounds like everything would take 10 times longer than it needs to. Also, did you break your mother's china?
I don't think that's important right now, actually. The important question is, should I lie about it? Kant says that lying to protect your own butt is an amoral action. Kant also says that you shouldn't lie because you're distorting the information other people have. And that means people can't make their own rational decisions. So Kant's idea of moral is this big system where everyone is honest about their situation and where everyone acts on these identical moral rules. Like, I don't know, morality robots?
Morality robots? Are you sure you're not writing fanfiction of 1984?
You know, I don't think they had fanfiction in 1984, are you?
Ugh. Also, there's been fanfiction since Dante's Inferno, you snob.
Anyway, Briggs thinks this is part of a reason why Schmidt lived the way he did. He was an introverted man who worked studiously. If you think about it, those behaviors make sense with Kant's theory. He was being the change he wanted to see in the world.
Albeit for me to disparage the polite and studious, but that sounds pretty dull.
Well, maybe Schmidt grew to think so too. What we do know, courtesy of our buddy Briggs, is that Schmidt attended a lecture given by a guest speaker around the same time, and apparently Schmidt didn't like what he heard.
And do you think that might have caused the change in attitude?
imagine.
Oh, please, not again.
You lived an honest life and survived a harsh and unforgiving childhood. You escaped the regimental bondage of your past and eked out a decent living as a professor, finding solace between the lines of dusty textbooks and old manuscripts penned by smart dead guys. It's a simple life. It's a humble life. At least until some no-name professor from the next city over shatters the peaceful illusion you built your faith around. Your world comes crashing down around you, and everything you know is suddenly a lie. This web.
Please, get to your point, Finn.
Okay, jeez. Look, Schmidt built this belief up where he plays by the rules he'd like everybody else to play by, even as everyone around him did as they please. Then, one day, boom, someone destroys the foundation he built himself up on. What does that mean for his life? He missed out because he believed in a lie and trusted that he was doing the right thing.
I think I see where this is going. You think Schmidt rebelled, right?
Exactly. Schmidt was a caterpillar loner, but when his faith in Kantian ethics was shattered, he formed a sinister cocoon and metamorphosed into a social butterfly. Butterfly of murder. What did life matter to him? He decided that he wanted to get the girl and wouldn't let a little murder stand in his way.
Okay, Finn. I think I see what you're getting at. Though you're starting to... what's the term?
Wax poetic?
Wax idiotic.
Jeez, harsh.
But I will admit, it sounds like there could, emphasis on could, be something to this. Traumatic events can have all kinds of debilitating effects on a person's mind, and a devastating rebuttal against his favorite thinker might open the floodgates.
Right? It must have been one hell of a rebuttal. I couldn't imagine having every belief flipped on its head like that, especially if I'd dedicated my life to following and teaching it. But what if it wasn't enough?
Oh no.
We have a man on the precipice, poised to fall, his worldview crumbling, his very identity called into question. Just one more push could lead him somewhere dark. Somewhere murderous.
Newcastle?
Just hear me out, Lady Killjoy.
I'm scared at your sudden earnestness, but proceed.
Demonic possession.
Finn.
I have the floor. You gave it to me. Now, listen as I say my piece.
Finn, come on. Surely not even you can expect me to just sit here and... oh, that's committed.
Bribery is low of me, I know, loyal listeners, but sometimes we must resort to extremes. Or in my case, donuts.
Proceed.
Anyway, as I was saying, demonic possession.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. Or at least, that's what seems to be the case. There's very little in our friend Schmidt's life to suggest a future of psychopathy. Lots of people grow up in abusive homes and turn out just fine. The likelihood of an abuse victim becoming an abuser is much lower than most third-rate cop shows would have you believe.
Amen.
So what else is there? A perfect storm. A person casting around for answers after losing all meaning. A space for something to crawl inside of and take root. Then, the sudden confidence, the new lease on life. A demon trying out their new meat suit.
You're not serious.
Aren't I? And I have evidence.
Oh? Did you consult your tarot cards?
Yes, but more on that soon. You see, there was a really active campus message board in the 90s. There's an archived version of it on the Wayback Machine.
Full of credible facts and witness testimony.
Full of denizens of our campus, past and present. And with a popular board dedicated to campus legends. Ones like the Murder Farm.
Uh-huh. And what did Budgie Smuggler 69 think about Schmidt's case?
Well, XX Burning Bridges XX had a lot to say, actually. They were apparently a student in one of Schmidt's classes at the time of the murders. According to them, Schmidt's personality shift was embraced by most of the students, but they remember a very specific meeting with him, after hours, about an essay. Apparently, as they entered his office, they were hit with a sudden wave of cold air and the smell of sulfur.
God forbid a man enjoy an egg sandwich in an air-conditioned room.
Another user anonymously commented that they had seen Schmitty break a mirror in the men's washroom. Apparently he looked at himself for a long moment before punching it.
Right. And then I suppose his head spun around 3 times and he vomited blood.
XX Burning Bridges XX replied with further conjecture that whilst his lectures had become more animated and easier to listen to, they had also noticed that he sometimes suddenly lost track of what he was saying entirely, like he was waking up from a long dream.
Ah, yes, clearly possession. Finn, they could be anyone.
Actually, I did cross-reference their posts. They knew a lot of campus-specific details that make me believe that he really did go here.
Sure, so maybe they did go here, but that hardly makes them credible.
Hey, here on Englewood After Dark, we consider every angle and possibility. Demonic possession is a documented phenomenon.
Well documented by whack jobs. What did you do? Type demonic possession to the search bar and look at the first page of results?
Oh ye of little faith. I also took out Malleus Maleficarum from the library.
That's a book on witch hunting that's written by a misogynist.
Huh. You know, that explains a lot. My point is that it is impossible to ignore that several of Schmitty's symptoms play out exactly like possession.
Or like a man with certain predilections finally allowing himself to act on impulse. He smashes the mirror because he's losing control of his anger, and it's been bubbling under his skin for so many years. He trails off mid-lecture because he sees a pretty brunette in class, and that gets him thinking about eviscerating her. These things have perfectly reasonable explanations.
We'll have to agree to disagree, Lady Killjoy.
Well, thank you to everyone who took the time to listen tonight. We'll be back next week for some amateur sleuthing, amateur philosophy, and even some amateur demonology, apparently.
And thanks, as always, to Professor Hannessy and the Theater Department for letting us use this room. And remember, if you have any comments or feedback, we'd love to hear from you guys.
But for now, so long.
Farewell.
And don't let the demons bite. I don't have a lot of time to talk, but I need to get this out there. These are the original episodes of Englewood After Dark, the undoctored ones. They don't know I have these yet, and they'll probably get taken down, but I have to try. You guys deserve to know the truth, and I need your help. They've been watching us for a long time. There's something we missed in these episodes, I know it. I'm going to post as many as I can before they find me. Please, find out what they want. What it wants. Share this with anyone you think might be in danger. We can beat this, I know we can. We have to. We've lost too much to give up now. I can't stay in one place for too long. Listen, learn, and stay safe. Just finished listening to Englewood After Dark Episode 1, starring Dennis Altman as Finn Nightingale, Hannah Brown as Eve Pemberley, Martin Laston as Marcus Emerson, and Brittany Finlay Hayes as Angela DeLuca. On-air music by the talented Athen, and opening music by Nicholas Gasparini. Written and sound designed by Hannah Brown, Dennis Altman, and A. Rose. Find out more on our website at englewoodafterdark.com.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.